We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning or next week for that matter.
He's on vacation.
He's on vacation. All right. Starting out, as we always do, with a local and a coal study.
Yeah. A couple of interesting topics this week, both kind of shaped up as sort of pseudo scandals by the local press, particularly the Seattle Times. The Seattle Times ran an article this week about Mayor McGinn's coal study that he commissioned back in December, saying that he didn't release the coal study's findings for 5 weeks. Well, what they were doing was they were counting those 5 weeks from the time that McGinn received the first draft of the report that he commissioned. And because he commissioned the report, it's really his responsibility to review it and make sure that it's comprehensive and that it's not biased and to suggest changes and to kind of oversee the entire production of the report. And 5 weeks is not unreasonable. In fact, that's actually a fairly speedy turnaround time in terms of first going from the first draft of a big report like that to a final draft. But what did the study itself actually show? And if you read the Seattle Times article, you should have been pretty confused, because I was. It wasn't until I actually looked at other media reporting on the report that I got a better idea of what was in that study. The coal trains and the export terminal at Cherry Point could cost the city over $500 million. Now, that's $500 million in losses. And those losses would be due to things like new infrastructure costs that, we would have to build in order to accommodate the trains, and reduced property values, with the bulk of it being attributable to reduced property values near railroad tracks. It would only bring in about $28 million in new jobs, and that's only if you factor in the PR jobs that are created by the coal industry and its lobbyists. And a lot of folks argue that that in itself is an inflated number. Now, the study, what's important about the study is that it was a very narrow one, looking at local economic impacts. It didn't look at broader economic impacts, like the impact on tourism, for example, or the impact on local businesses from, noise and vibration from the trains and that sort of thing. It didn't look at any of the environmental impacts of exporting coal, for example, its impact on global warming. It didn't look at coal dust that would blow off of the trains, and it's been disputed among different folks, supporters and opponents, of how much that would be, but nobody doubts that there would be some coal dust pollution, diesel engine exhaust from the trains. It didn't look at the health impacts of the noise or vibration from a large number of heavy trains moving through the area. So, it was a very limited study. Now, fortunately, there are a few more studies to come, especially the State Department of Ecology's study and Whatcom County's review of the proposed terminal. Those also have yet to be released. Also, the mayor commissioned a separate study on traffic and transportation impacts of the coal trains, and that hasn't been finished yet. But really, the biggest argument against the coal terminal and against the coal trains is that coal prices worldwide have fallen. They're about half, maybe a little more than half, what they once were when they peaked in 2011 at about $120, $130 a ton. Now they're closer to about $60 to $70. Which is kind of interesting. These Midwest coal mining companies assume that prices were going to stay high because demand in China was going to keep growing and growing, because the Chinese economy was speeding forward like a freight train. Well, China's economy has slowed now, and there are a lot of other coal producing countries that are much closer to China who were able to ramp up their production, and now there's a glut of coal on the market, particularly coal from Australia and Indonesia, to feed that Chinese market. So I think that in itself is going to be the death knell for the proposed terminal at Cherry Point.
Hmm. All right. Moving on.
Yeah, let's talk about the second scandal,
so-called
scandal. Yeah, the SPD asked City Attorney Pete Holmes this week to target, that is, arrest and prosecute 28 repeat offenders of Seattle's civility laws. Now, folks who don't know, the civility ordinances were passed in the mid-1990s when Mark Sidran was city attorney, and he made a big push for those laws to be passed. They make it illegal to lay down, sit, drink from an open container, spit or urinate on the city's sidewalks. So essentially, they're civil violations, but they don't rise to the level of real criminal acts. Now, the SPD scolded Holmes for not going after folks who are cited for these civil violations, but who don't show up in court. Now, I just want to point out, too, that when the civility laws were passed, there was a lot of protest about them because folks recognized immediately that the civility laws would be criminalizing the homeless and the mentally ill. And that's really what has happened. And Holmes' response to this, of course, is that these civil violations don't rise to the level of criminal acts. And when you arrest somebody, prosecute them for a non-appearance for these minor violations, you're turning those minor violations into misdemeanor charges, which would make them criminal acts. And then those are going on people's records. And that Holmes himself is essentially saying, I don't believe in the civility laws since I'm not really helping to enforce them. Now, he pointed out, too, that if you really want to help the problem of homelessness and mentally ill folks on the street, you should be providing those folks with services. Things like drug and alcohol treatment programs, mental health services, social and caseworkers inside the SPD to help deal with particularly people who have mental health problems, because the SPD has been notoriously bad. Police officers in the city have been notoriously bad at being able to deal with folks who are mentally ill. There should be, of course, a greater emphasis by the city on building low-income housing for folks. And also, as Mike showed with one of his guests earlier this morning, we need to have a better provision of food to the homeless, because you can't think when you're hungry, literally. And a lot of the folks who condemn, who support the civility laws and condemn the kind of work that activists like the person you had on earlier this morning are doing, are folks who just don't understand what it's like to be desperate and really, really, really hungry and homeless. They really don't have a clue. So Holmes rightly complained that the SPD took what should have been an internal discussion about law enforcement priorities and made it public when it copied the city council and media outlets on this correspondence. And I think he's absolutely right. Holmes has been very critical of the mayor and the SPD over resisting the Department of Justice's oversight, and also been critical of how the laws are being enforced and what the law enforcement priorities are in the city of Seattle. And there's no way for the city attorney and the SPD to come to any kind of agreement when this kind of stuff is being played out in public.
All right. Moving on, the Mayor Mike McGinn comes out with a gun-free business program.
Yeah, McGinn a few years back tried to ban guns in city parks and community centers, but that, of course, was struck down by the courts as unconstitutional. And this week, he's going for banning guns in private businesses by bringing out this new program called his Gun-Free Business Program and asking businesses to voluntarily sign on to put stickers in their windows saying that people who are carrying guns are not welcome in their stores and their businesses. Now, it's really a PR exercise because, these businesses can't know who's going to be packing heat when they come into their establishments, and a lot of people don't read stickers in windows anyway. But what I find kind of interesting is that McGinn cited this as, oh, this is a great step forward in gun control, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really not. It takes the focus off of real meaningful gun control initiatives, like, for example, Initiative 594, which would close the gun show loophole and impose background checks for most private gun sales. That's really where people's attention should be right now, is trying to help boost enforcement of the existing laws in relation to weapons in society. And what I find kind of interesting, too, is that McGinn said that he was appealing to private business owners' rights to refuse service to whomever they like. But I want to point out that, you know, that right is limited. And we know that it is limited if you just think for a minute. Think about, for example, whites-only establishments in the Deep South during the Civil Rights era. That was overturned, and for very good reason, because that infringed on other people's rights. Think also about a more recent example of a bakery here in the state of Washington that refused to serve a gay couple. They would not make a wedding cake for a gay couple. That, again, should be overturned, and for very good reason, because it infringes on other people's rights. And I think that this effort to ban guns in businesses will also be the same. It will be infringing on people's rights to bear arms under the Constitution.
All right. Keeping up our relentless pace here. Women's health care, Attorney General weighing in this one.
Yeah, the state attorney general, Bob Ferguson, issued an opinion on Wednesday. Any public health district in Washington state that provides maternity care must now also provide equivalent contraception and abortion care. This is state law under I-120, which was passed by voters in 1991. He was asked to review this issue by State Senator Kevin Ranker of Orcas Island. Now, Ranker's district includes Bellingham, Orcas Island, and much of Skagit County. He has a major concern about this because several Skagit County public hospitals are affiliating with religious healthcare organizations, for example, Peace Health and Providence, which are both Catholic-based medical organizations. Providence, for example, is affiliating with Swedish Medical Center here in Seattle, and people are a little bit concerned about whether Swedish will provide a full range of women's reproductive services because the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has forbidden certain medical procedures, including abortion. So that's a very serious concern of a lot of patients of these hospitals. Ferguson verified that, yes, if you have a public health district that is taking public money, because most of these public hospital districts get money from the state, they must provide the complete range of women's reproductive services. And that includes contraception and abortion.
All right. Moving on to national and numerous wildfires going across the country this week.
Yeah, every time you turn on the TV and listen to the news, you're hearing about another wildfire here in the West. Spending on wildfire suppression this year is already skyrocketed over $1 billion. The 10-year average is $1.4 billion. That's typically what we spend in an average year. And the fire season is barely half over, if that. Last year, we spent $1.9 billion on wildfire suppression. And currently, there are about 51 uncontrolled wildfires in the West, and they range from eastern Washington east to Montana, from Idaho, where there are a lot of wildfires raging, south to Colorado and into California, where the wildfire season literally lasts through October. So the amount of money that we might end up spending, that the United States might end up spending on suppressing wildfire, could be literally much more than last year, which was almost $2 billion. Now, this has exhausted the Forest Service's budget for firefighting, and they're having to dip into their maintenance funds. And the problem with this is that the maintenance funds includes most of the money used to thin brush in order to avoid future wildfires. Now, a lot of this is due to the sequestration, Congress's really, really bad budget deal, which mandated cuts in federal agencies and departments all across the board. That meant that the Forest Service budget had to be cut by 5%, and that forced the layoff of 500 firefighters and the loss of about 50 fire engines right before the wildfire season began. Also, I should point out, too, that because of global warming, another thing that Congress refuses to address, hotter, drier summers in the West have led to much, much higher risk for wildfires, and the fact that we have more precipitation during the winters, another feature of global warming, means that we have a much higher growth rate of underbrush in the forest. That makes it also much more of a fire hazard during the summers when it's very, very dry. And also because people are moving out and living more in the wilderness, that puts more homes and more people at risk, and there's much more need for fire suppression. So a lot of things kind of converging to make wildfires one of the biggest and one of the most expensive side effects of global warming.
All right. Racial equality poll out this week.
Yeah, there was a poll out this week on racial equality. It was conducted by the Pew Research Center. They were looking at changes in racial perceptions, discrimination, and economic opportunity in the 50 years since Martin Luther King made his I Have a Dream speech. And what they found is that we still have a long way to go, that some of the results of the poll included things like 1 in 3 blacks and 1 in 5 Hispanics say that they were treated unfairly in the past year. That's, you know, this is not 10 years ago. This is last year. 7 in 10 blacks and more than 1/4 of all whites agree that blacks don't get equal treatment in our cops and in our courts. Our judicial system. Economic differences have widened literally in the last 50 years. Excuse me. The average 3-member black household makes only 59% of what a similar white household makes. The median net worth, this is, you know, what you own versus what you make in salary or wages every year. The median net worth of white households is 14 times greater than the median net worth of black households. Also, in 1960, in addition to the economic impacts, there are some other impacts as well. In 1960, black men were 5 times more likely to be in jail or prison. Now, in our enlightened age, that number is 6 times more likely, which makes you scratch your head and say, huh, what has changed, if anything? And nearly half of all Americans, including 44% of whites and 79% of blacks, say that a lot more progress needs to happen, and they are absolutely right.
All right. Moving on, sentencing this week for Bradley Manning.
Yeah, Bradley, now known as Chelsea Manning, was sentenced to 35 years in prison this week. That's the worst sentence ever given to a government whistleblower or a person who leaked classified information from the U.S. government, and is outrageous, I really think, particularly considering that Chelsea Manning has already served over 3 years in prison, and much of that was in isolation, and she was subject to a lot of abuse during that time. She'll be eligible for parole in about 8 years. Just as a reminder, Chelsea, formerly Bradley Manning, leaked about 700,000 documents to WikiLeaks, including the video which WikiLeaks entitled Collateral Murder, which showed the military, U.S. military bombing civilians and killing many people in Iraq, including a couple of Reuters reporters. Right after the sentencing, Manning announced that she is transgendered, which I thought was very interesting, the timing on that. It really shows you how much of a bias still exists in the military, that Chelsea Manning, 3 years after, you know, having served 3 years in prison and having served in the military for many years, would have to wait, definitely have to wait, until after her trial was completed and after the sentencing phase was over to be able to announce that she was transgendered. Really sort of points to the fact that even though Don't Ask, Don't Tell is over, people may ask, you might tell, but you should probably decide not to, if at all possible. Now, it's also kind of points to this issue that a lot of folks don't understand about people who are transgendered, what a struggle it is to hide who you really are. And when you do finally announce, what a relief it can be, because think about it. It was pretty gutsy for Chelsea Manning to make this move right before having to serve 35 years in a men's prison. That's not something to look forward to. And to make this announcement right before that takes a lot of courage. So, some sad news for Chelsea Manning this week, but also a little bit of an inspiring act by her.
All right. Moving on, further NSA revelations this week, developments.
Yeah, some revelations and some developments in the NSA leaks. David Miranda, the partner of Glenn Greenwald, who has been the main reporter at The Guardian, who has been publishing a lot of the data on the NSA revelations from documents given to him by Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower. David Miranda, Glenn Greenwald's partner, was detained for 9 hours at Heathrow, and all of his electronic devices were seized under Britain's anti-terrorism law, which is called Schedule 7. He did not even enter the UK. I just want to point this out. He was in the international transit section of Heathrow Airport because he had just landed from a flight from Berlin, Germany, and he was waiting for a flight to Brazil. He was not even planning to enter Britain. But the cops were waiting for him nevertheless, which leads you to ask, how did the British police even know where he was and that he was going to transfer through the Heathrow Airport? Well, all I can say is welcome to the new world of global surveillance. The NSA is watching you and watching you at all times. Now, British intelligence this week also went into the offices of the Guardian newspaper, and they forced the Guardian's editors to destroy two hard drives which contained data given to them by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. And this is even though the editors protested that multiple copies of this data existed in Guardian offices in New York and in other parts of the world, that it would be futile for them to destroy this information. The British intelligence services still insisted that it be done. The Guardian has since announced that they will not do reporting on the NSA revelations from their London office. They have entered into an agreement with the New York Times, their New York office, to publish the NSA material here in the USA, where it will have probably the most impact. And that they will also concentrate especially on material dealing with British government collaboration with the NSA. So a little bit of a kickback there from The Guardian. Now, The Guardian also this week published some additional documents relating to the NSA revelations. And this week what they revealed is that the NSA paid Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and other tech companies compensation for access to their data. Yes, indeed. Taxpayer funds were used to reimburse these companies for the inconvenience of giving the NSA access to their customer data. This is something that the companies did not reveal, and many companies still deny that they have allowed the NSA access. But The Guardian had the documents, and the documents were definitely NSA documents, and they published them. So that's something to take home with you today, is that, yes, indeed, the companies you use for your internet access and your online searches and so on, the company that you buy software from is getting money, taxpayer money, from the NSA to turn your data right around and give it to them.
So you're not only paying them for the service.
For the service, yes.
We're also paying them
to spy on us. Yeah. Uh-huh. They're getting paid, actually, getting paid twice. Yeah.
It was also interesting with those hard drives that they literally had to pulverize those hard drives with like a metal grinder
in order to destroy them.
The hard drives and the memory chips.
The persistence of data. Yeah. Hmm. Interesting.
All right. Well, that takes us on then to international and Syria.
And Syria. Yeah. What appeared to be a chemical weapons attack on an eastern suburb of Damascus this week in Syria. Three victims there have been smuggled to Lebanon, where their blood will be analyzed, although any hospital, I think, with a good laboratory could be able to do it. But there must now be such a problem with infrastructure in Syria now, after months and months of war, almost, what is it, 2 years now of war, that finding a laboratory that can do that analysis must be particularly difficult. It's not clear, of course, who may have fired the rockets that spilled the chemical agents. Now, it's also not particularly clear whether it was a chemical weapons attack. The Syrian conflict, I just want to point out, is fractured into multiple combatants on both sides. So you have militias on the government side that are not government controlled but are fighting on their behalf. You have militias on the opposition side, which are not part of the Free Syrian Army, but are a lot of whom are Islamic fundamentalists who are not under the Free Syrian Army's control, who are fighting on their behalf. And you also have a lot of criminal gangs, because war creates the space for criminal gangs to form and to operate with impunity. So anybody could have spilled chemicals, could have bombed a chemical factory or warehouse, could have shot off a rocket with an aging munition, with aging chemical weapons munitions in it, and not even known what they were deploying, much less what the rocket carried or whether or not it would be effective. Now, I say this because a lot of the reported victims had a range of symptoms. Several people died fairly quickly and I don't want to say easily, but they succumbed easily to the attack, and many people had very mild symptoms. That makes you wonder if, in fact, it was maybe an aging munition that had been bought on the black market. And when you're looking at something like that, it could be anybody. It could be a member of a loyalist group that's fighting on behalf of the Syrian government, but not under Syrian government control. It could be one of these Islamic militias fighting on behalf of the Free Syrian Army, but not under their control. Could be the Syrian government. Could be anybody, literally. So that's what we should keep in mind. Early U.S. and European Union intelligence says that they think it is Syrian loyalists, meaning they think it's a group that's fighting on behalf of the Assad government. And, of course, their assumption is that Assad would have known and personally approved such a thing, which I doubt seriously. That assumes that the Syrian battlefield is black and white, and anyone who has been there or tried to get there knows that that's not true. So.
And in response to this, we're seeing media coverage of the U.S. looking at potential direct action now.
Yeah, looking at a potentially doing something. Now, the question of what they might do is an interesting one, because the Obama administration has proven that they don't really want to do much of anything. There's pretty strong disagreement among Obama's advisors on what should be done. I know Joe Biden, for example, is one of the big supporters of airstrikes. The question is, what would be the goal of those airstrikes? Because as we know from the past, airstrikes tend to punish the civilian population just as much, if not more, than the government in control. Also, Obama has come out and said that he is not for imposing a no-fly zone, which might in fact be probably the most effective thing to do, particularly since the Syrian government has made great gains by the use of military helicopters that might actually help the Syrian people the most. But imposing a no-fly zone requires a lot of resources, and it takes a lot of time, and it can also be pretty tricky, because again, you're bombing what you think are government facilities, but can often turn out to be civilian infrastructure instead.
Right. Events.
Yeah, events this week. This weekend is the 10th annual race conference at Seattle University in the Piggott Building. You can get tickets through Brown Paper Tickets, or you can register at the conference. The conference starts at 9 a.m. this morning, so if you're going to register there at the door, I would suggest you go about a half an hour early. That was a half an hour ago, but you can probably go now. Set the time machine, scoot back a half an hour, but you can still go. Also, this weekend on Sunday is Melrose Market's family-oriented street festival, with the proceeds going to Teen Feed. That's Sunday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Melrose Avenue on Capitol Hill, and that's a free event. Also, this coming Thursday is the nationwide strike for a $15 an hour wage for fast food workers. Fast food workers all over the city will be joining in that strike. Workers from McDonald's, Taco Bell, and various other fast food joints that have struck earlier will be striking again this Thursday. And I urge everyone to support them by not eating a fast food meal on Thursday.
Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found online at www.eatthestate.org.